He called one of the guards over and gave the instruction. The dwarf guard trotted off. Bendelbar thought he could sniff Orkness in the air again, but that was impossible. Not in here. He dismissed it as imagination. "So, what's new in Gödlegard?" Kartef was feeling chatty. He undid the buckles to pull the tarpaulins and the leather covers off the cages. "I haven't been back here for ages. Are the orcs still hanging out in Taboribor?" Bendelbar got the other soldiers to help. The crates containing these strange dwarfs, known in Gödlegard only as undergroundlings, were revealed bit by bit. The trader had 2 dozen of them. They were huddled together in the middle of their prisons and were staring at their distant relations mistrustfully and in silence. "In Taboribor! Nothing happening there anymore." Bendelbar shook his head, unable to take his eyes off the captives. "After the Star of Judgment struck, all the evil went away." "That's not what I hear," replied Kartef, jumping up to the front of the wagon, where there were 5 barrels. He opened the left-hand one, took out a few hardened loaves, and chucked them into the cages. The undergroundlings grabbed the bread greedily. "There are said to be strange creatures about the place, murdering and pillaging." Now Bendelbar did turn his attention to the man. "Rumours spread quickly in the outer lands." The tradesman smiled at the dwarf. "Don't forget I am a merchant. Merchants are quick to panic when their wares might be in danger." With a powerful leap that Bendelbar wouldn't have thought him capable of, the trader landed at his feet. "Do these creatures exist or not?"
"They do exist," he sighed. "But we're close to catching them."
He placed his hand on the handle of the axe he carried stuck in his belt.
"You can set your mind at ease."
There was a loud crash behind them. The base of the cage had broken, and a dozen of the undergroundlings dropped through onto the stone floor. Initially, Bendelbar thought the cart must have given way under the weight, having suffered damage on the long journey. But when he saw the undergroundlings were making off left and right unrestrained, he realized they had unchained themselves.
"Stop them!"
yelled Kartef, catching the arm of a guard who was about to fell one with a spear thrust.
"Don't hurt them! They're my property, got it? I want them back safe and sound. There'll be hell to pay if you kill one."
Bendelbar pushed him to one side.
"After them!"
he commanded, reaching for his long horn. Then a whole side fell out on the second cage. Loose bolts clattered and rolled away. The dwarf was caught on the head and shoulders by the iron bars of the cage as the remaining 12 undergroundlings made a bid for freedom, rushing the guards. Grabbing the sentry's weapons and armor, they raced to the exits. Bendelbar could not move. The heavy iron grating kept him pinned to the ground. He couldn't even move his arms, let alone sound the alarm with a blast on his horn.
"I'll get help," said Kartef, taking the dwarf's axe. "Just in case they attack me on the way," he explained. "You'll get it back. Which way do I go?" "My bugle," groaned Bendelbar. "Blow the alarm!"
But however hard the tradesman tried to sound the horn, he couldn't produce anything more convincing than a damp fart.
"They'll be after our diamond," grunted the dwarf, nodding to the left-hand passageway. "Run and warn the queen."
Kartev nodded to him.
"Right."
He stood up and ran off, faster than Bendelbar had ever seen a man run before. He could do nothing but wait for help. It was a long time coming. He heard alarm horns sounding, excited voices, weapons clashing, and now and then the sound of a dwarf in pain and furious. Every fiber in Bendelbar's being demanded he join the hunt for the intruders, but he was helpless under the iron grating. At last, steps came near. Kartev's coarse voice appeared above him.
"I'm back," he said.
Many hands helped to move the heavy grid. His shoulder painful and his skull throbbing, Bendelbar slid out from under the metal bars. Someone helped him to his feet. Before him stood the trader and Queen Zamtes, and maybe 60 warriors with blood on their weapons.
"What happened?" he asked, bowing to his queen. "We had to kill most of them. They were so wild," she said. "They even got as far as the treasure chamber. But I don't know what the outcome was. Terrible confusion."
Zamtes looked at Kartef.
"Two of them fled, but you won't get them back alive."
She handed him a bag that clinked in the familiar way, gold coins.
"Take this as compensation, and as my thanks for your attempt to aid us in our fight against the undergroundlings in the treasure chamber."
The man bowed.
"Thank you, noble lady. I am sorry that our commerce should take this form. I would have preferred to hand the captives into your keeping alive."
He pointed to the broken base of the cage.
"I would never have thought them capable of breaking it open with a few pieces of iron. And they freed themselves from their chains, too." "It is not your fault. My guard should have checked the wagon more thoroughly," she said, looking at Bendelbar. "From now on, I shall expect my gate guards to be 3 times as watchful."
She spoke the words cunningly.
"Return to your post, and let this be a lesson to you. This raid could easily have been successful."
She turned and moved off, followed by her retinue and surrounded by her bodyguards. Bendelbar grimaced. He was in pain and was in disgrace with the queen. The last piece of news in particular would not be popular with the chief of his clan. He'd get another dressing down there for sure. He looked angrily at Kartef, who was loading the first bits of ruined cage onto his cart.
"Leave it!"
He gave the order for the rest of the guards to take over. Not long afterwards, Kartef was on his way back to the Outer Lands, accompanied by Bendelbar with what remained of his vehicle. It was a long journey for them both. 3 sun orbits on the broadest of roads in the dwarf realm, past many wonders, large and small, constructed out of stone, steel, and iron. The sight of statues, bridges, and murals raised the dwarf's spirits. Although the tradesman had received adequate recompense for his trouble, he was not happy about the outcome of his journey. It seemed to Bendelbar the man was mourning the loss of the undergroundlings. At any rate, he wasn't appreciating the wonders they passed. Seeing as he did not have the slightest wish to communicate, they were both silent when they went back through the gates of Ironhold. More than a mere,
"Fracas, keep you!"
did not cross their lips. Bendelbar stopped. He ordered the outer gate to be closed and the wall gate to be opened for the trader. Then he rushed up to the battlements to follow the progress of the ox cart with his eyes. Just as he was wondering why Kartev, after all that long waiting period at the gates, had not gone into Girdlegard with his gold to buy goods to sell on his way home, the man was doing something even stranger. When he had left the last ramparts behind him, Kartev stopped to chat to a new arrival who was heading for West Ironhold. He pressed the reins of his oxen into the man's hand and continued on his way without his cart or belongings.
"Rackus, what is it with this fellow?" wondered Bendelbar, coming down from his vantage point.
He wanted to find out. He had just commandeered a pony and ordered 5 mounted guards to accompany him when a messenger hurried past, storming into the quarters of Gondagar Bitterfist of the clan of the Bitterfists, the commander of West Ironhold.
"Wait,"
said Bendelbar to his companions, guessing that this agitation had something to do with the trader. It took just about as long as a dwarf needs to draw an axe, take aim, and hurl it at an enemy, that's if you had a second one on you, before the threatening, thunderous voice of the stronghold's main alarm horn sounded. It was powered by huge bellows and activated from inside the commander's quarters. It sent out its continuous message along the ramparts, up the slopes of the mountain, and all along the ravine. The door flew open,
Gondagar appeared, pulling his helmet on over his black curls and gesturing at the dwarf next to Bendelbar.
You there! Dismount! Let me on!
He ordered, swinging himself up into the saddle.
Let's go! Stop that traitor!
He yelled, spurring the horse so that it reared up at the pain and galloped off.
In all that confusion, he's replaced the diamond with a false one made of glass!
Bendelbar ran hot and cold. His guilt was growing by the minute. The dwarves on their ponies raced along the twists and turns of the ravine, and the gates opened before them in the nick of time. Every hoofbeat brought them deeper into the outer lands. They followed the broad but uneven road. However hard they pushed, their mounts did not catch up with the trader. Round each corner they expected to see him, but were disappointed. There was nowhere he could have hidden. The walls of the chasm either went vertically upwards, or there was a precipice down on the other side. The stone was too smooth to give any hand or foothold. Not until the sun was sinking over the red mountains and darkness was falling over the area like a black cloth did they come to a halt. Gondagar cursed roundly.
Where the hell has the bastard got to?
He called out furiously to the echoing mountain walls.
He must be in league with Tion, or how else have we not overtaken him? May Vrakas strike him down with his hammer!
Bendelbar's pony snorted in alarm and skidded round a harmless piece of rock on the roadside. The other mounts blew sharply through their nostrils and pricked up their ears, dancing on the spot, and only kept from bolting by the riders pulling hard on the reins. Then Bendelbar smelt it, too. Orcs. The smell of their sweat carried on the evening air, polluting it. He slid out of the saddle and took his axe in his hand. Gondagar followed suit.
I can smell them, but I can't see them, he growled. What devilry is this?
Bendelbar approached the rock the pony had shied from and held his weapon at the ready.
Perhaps there's a secret under the stone.
Suddenly the rock turned into Kartev. The trader threw himself forward with a huge cudgel in his right hand, hitting the dwarf on his injured shoulder. The blow was hard, too powerful to have come from a normal man, who would not have been strong enough to wield a large club like that with one hand. Equally, it was impossible for a normal man to take on the shape of a rock. Something was not right here. Bendelbar fell against the pony and under the whirling hooves of the terrified animal. Before he could protect himself from the kicks and get upright again, clenching his teeth against the pain, the fight with Kartev was decided. But not in the way Bendelbar had expected. His dwarf friends lay moaning or silent on the path, the man standing over them, taking deep breaths. He looked down at Bendelbar.
Stay where you are. I've got what I wanted, he said, his voice sounding more guttural now, more like an orc. I don't want to hurt you.
But I want to fight, yelled Bendelbar, lifting his axe and leaping forward. Vrakas, come to my aid against the accursed greenskin!
His axe blow was parried, and the cudgel jabbed him on the cheek and pushed him over. To the dwarf it felt like being kicked by a pony. Half stunned, but determined not to submit to the enemy, he got to his feet and brandished his axe to keep the attacker at arm's length. He could see the hazy outline of an orc in front of him.
You won't get away,
he threatened, his words slurred. The broad shadow rushed past him, and his blade met empty air.
But I've already got away,
the being called from afar.
Go back to West Ironhald and have your wounds treated.
The sound of speeding hooves was heard. Bendelbar shook his head, trying to clear it. It was no good. He would have to wait until his head stopped spinning and his vision was no longer blurred. When he stood up, Gondagar was just coming round. The cudgel had made a substantial dent in his helmet, and blood was trickling through his black hair, down his chin, his beard, and his neck.
What a ghastly country, he groaned.
You can't tell the difference between the orcs and the people.
apart from the smell, that is. He took in his surroundings. He's stolen our pony.
The dwarves slowly got to their feet. Bruises, one broken arm, painful cuts, but no fatalities. Bendelbar was not the only one to express surprise at that. The orc had spared them. This incident would surely give rise to intensive debate at the dwarf folks' assembly. They gave up their pursuit and returned to West Ironhald. Halfway there, support troops from the Firstling Kingdom came out to meet them. A band of about 50 male and female dwarves were approaching on horseback. As quickly as possible, Gondagar related their encounter and spoke of the peculiar abilities displayed by their adversary.
"Beware of his magic. It seems he can transform himself into anything he likes. But he still smells of orc," he told them. "Pay heed to your noses and your ponies. They are less likely to be fooled than your eyes."
The leader of the troop nodded.
"And you be careful back in the stronghold. What you drink. Several wells have been poisoned. The experts are testing them one by one."
"What?"
Bendelbar stopped short in the act of opening his own flask.
100 dead have been discovered to the south of the Red Range. They must have died several orbits ago. They all showed signs of bleeding from their mouths, eyes, noses and ears. The clan of the Hardhammers has been completely wiped out. The Queen thinks the Thirdlings are behind it."
He nodded at them grimly.
"They'll tell you more back at the fortress. We must push on."
The troop surged forward, leaving the 5 dwarves behind in a cloud of dust. Yet more deaths among his kind. But this time Bendelbar was certain that the raid did not stem from the undergroundlings. If it had been the undergroundlings, the weight of his own responsibility would have been incalculable.
Chapter 8. Gerdlegard, Kingdom of Goregar, Parista, Early Summer 6241st Solar Cycle.
"Do you think the elves are going to cause trouble about the Alandor thing, scholar?"
Ironheart was growing increasingly uneasy the nearer they got to Parista. On the horizon now, the city, the future seat of Goregar's administration, promised reunions with old friends, and probably with old enemies. The dwarf had not forgotten the incriminating finger marks he had left on the elves' holy stone, nor had Tungdil.
"We won't let it get that far," said his companion, scratching his pony behind the ear. "The good thing about this assembly is that we can tell Lutacil what you did face to face."
He glanced at Goda. They had spoken to her about her master's elf-land mishap. The dwarf girl kept out of the exchange, but followed every word with silent glee.
"Right."
Ironheart resigned himself to his fate. It was difficult to predict what consequences might result from his having touched the monument.
"It didn't break, and it didn't crack," he said,
eliminating the worst-case scenario.
"It left a stain, that's all. I bet it'll go away when it's polished up."
He clapped his thigh.
"It'll be fine. Bit of elbow grease and it'll be as good as new. If there's still a problem, we can send one of our master masons to show the elves how to treat a decent piece of stone, so that a perfectly clean hand won't leave marks."
"Your words flow like molten gold. Could it be that you were trying to reassure yourself?"
grinned Tungdil.
"Me? Am I bothered? Who would I have to be worried about?
Lutacil, perhaps?"
"Rubbish. Not scared of elves."
The warrior fell into a sulk and urged his pony on ahead. The sooner he met the Lord of the Elves and could explain what had happened, he might need his friend's help there, the sooner the punishment would be over with.
"Sounds like it, though," whispered Goda to her pony.
Ironheart looked back over his shoulder.
"Goda, get down. You're going to walk."
"What?"
She sounded incensed.
"It's not your place to question me, girl. Carry your baggage while you're about it."
He turned his face away quickly to hide his grin. He really enjoyed tormenting her. Obedient but furious, Goda slipped from the saddle, threw the bags over her shoulder, and stomped along next to her pony.
What on earth's the point? I wanted combat training, not to learn how to be a porter.
Listen, a woman fighter needs strong legs to stand firm, he said swiftly. Imagine you're marching along, reckoning any second, with a snout-face attack. Have you heard the one about the orc that asks the dwarf the way?
Goda snorted. Tongdil laughed, hearing a curse in the sound. But his levity was a little forced. His thoughts were with injured Belindis, back in Lot Ionan's vaults. He had been puzzled by his own mixed feelings on leaving her behind. On the one side, he was extremely worried about his wife. On the other, he was pleased to be away from her again. He could not fathom this discontent. It had looked, that first night, as if they had a new chance together. But the longer he played with that idea, imagining a long life with Belindis, the more frightening it seemed. He could not understand why. He was still fond of her. Tungdil shifted in the saddle and gazed at Parista's city walls. The city was a masterpiece designed by Fergus. Perhaps that's what it was. He was still fond of her, but there was nothing deeper behind it. They were like brother and sister, like comrades in arms.
And then the dwarf laughed and went on his way.
Tungdil caught the closing words of Ironheart's joke. Goda was having trouble suppressing a grin. The corners of her mouth would not obey her. Dimples were forming, in spite of her efforts to remain deadly serious. You couldn't be furious and want to smile at the same time. It was a very good joke. Boindil's attempts to lift the mood were met with merry laughter. All of them joined in. They could not help it. They rode into the city, and as soon as they had announced themselves, were taken to the assembly tent. A few smaller tents had been put up to serve for more private discussions.
"Let's go to Gandagar and explain what's happened. Then we'll see Lutasil," Tungdil suggested.
Ironheart nodded his agreement. Goda's face was shiny with sweat. She emptied her drinking flask in one go and looked round for a fountain where she could refill it.
"Don't worry, apprentice. You'll get something soon enough,"
Ironheart grinned at her.
"How are the old legs?"
She lifted first the left foot, then the right. "Both still there," she retorted, wiping the perspiration off her forehead. A dark blonde lock of hair clung to her cheek.
"And both of them quite keen to kick someone's backside, master," she grinned. "An orc backside, of course."
Perhaps it was the light here in Parista, perhaps it was their surroundings, or perhaps it was the dwarf girl's sparkling eyes that suddenly made Ironheart quite enjoy looking at her. From one second to the next, his feelings changed. He became unsure of himself.
"Let's see what there is," he stammered, and averted his eyes quickly.
Something that shouldn't happen was happening. Not with her. They made their way over to the tent, flying the Forthling banner. The sentries announced their arrival at once. Goda stayed outside, but Tungdil had someone take her a drink. Gandagar received them, stretching out a hand to each dwarf.
"Events are threatening to overwhelm us," he said, noting with pleasure the change in Tungdil's appearance. He sensed the new vitality. "I was just about to address the clan leaders about a campaign to the Outer Lands, but now I've had to come to Parista with the Assembly to deal with the newest outrage."
Tungdil thought that the High King's face was far more deeply lined than before. Worry was taking its toll.
"How did you get on with the elves?"
Gandagar's eyes strayed to Ironheart's shorn head.
"Is this a new fashion?" "A fight. Tungdil can explain."
Boindil preferred not to have to say much, or he'd find himself confessing the truth to his sovereign. Tungdil bowed his head.
To be honest, sire, it was quite boring. We didn't get to see Lutacil. They fed us. They showed us only places of no significance.
He lowered his voice.
I think they were trying to keep something from us. They kept secret from us. Yet we have let their people see everything. It is not fair. With your permission, I should like to address these issues with Prince Lutacil. He is here, isn't he?
No.
Gundagar poured some water, and they took the polished gold cups he proffered.
He has sent representatives, Villanoil and Tiwalun. They said he'd be coming along later because something important needed discussing first.
Boindil frowned.
That's what they told us, too. It must be something really huge if it's taking this long to debate.
He glanced at Tungdil. Now life was going to get difficult for him. The last people he wanted to meet here in Perista were their Alandor elf guides, who were very likely to know all about what he'd done. Tungdil was silent, looking at the contents of his beaker.
Strange things are happening in Alandor.
What do you mean?
Asked Gundagar in concern.
I mean just that. Something strange is happening in Alandor.
His old gruffness broke out. He pulled himself together.
I hope there will prove to be an innocent explanation.
He emptied his drink, bowed, and put down the cup.
When does the session begin, Your Majesty?
We should already have reconvened. They will sound a bugle.
Tungdil looked at Gundagar.
I have bad news. My diamond has been stolen. A new monster invaded Lot Ionan's vaults and attacked us. Belindis was injured.
He summarized the events.
We lost track of the monster. It escaped off through the rocks, where it left no prints. Then we got your order to come straight to Perista.
So you've lost your stone as well. The same has happened to the firstlings. The shape-shifting orc and a handful of beardless undergroundlings robbed the firstling queen.
Gundagar let out a long breath, clenching his fists.
And there's more bad news. Xamtes suspects the thirdlings have poisoned their wells in the Red Mountains. Countless dwarfs had died. Men, women and children, before anyone noticed the water was poisoned. The experts have found that the fatal effects don't develop until you've drunk a certain amount. Boiling the water doesn't help at all. They have to bring their drinking water from a long distance away. In the Red Range, no one trusts anyone now.
This suspicion will spread when the dwarf realms learn about the poisoned cisterns,
Tungdil reflected. His hope that the Thirdlings might ever assimilate peaceably had died. The age-old, deep-seated hatred amongst some of the dwarves was still fermenting. The insidious lust for revenge was hitting the other dwarf folks more cruelly than ever. And those Thirdlings loyal to their origins would soon become disaffected. Things would get worse.
Perhaps it is better to rally the Thirdlings who are living dispersed in other communities and put them all together as a tribe somewhere away from the Dwarflands,
Tungdil said thoughtfully. The bugle sounded, summoning Gerdlegard's great and good back to the conference table. Their discussion must end for now.
With you, then, as their king?
Gundagar picked up the idea quickly. He put his helmet under his arm.
I was thinking as much. We ought to discuss it with the clans and with the Freelings as soon as we've dealt with the matter of the diamonds. Maybe there's a place for the Thirdlings amongst the free towns.
What?
Tungdil bit his tongue, suppressing the words.
What rubbish!
He laid his hand on Keenfire's axe head.
Would it be a good idea to exile them again? I'm not sure if the Freelings would want so many Thirdlings in their towns. If I were their king, I'd be afraid of armed insurrection. Who would stop them?
Oh, this is all so ghastly, cursed Ireheart.
Anyone would think Vrakas had granted us 5 cycles of peace purely to thrust us straight into the furnace now. The diamonds are being stolen, orcs and monsters stalk our lands, the wells are poisoned, and the elves are cooking up Vrakas knows what devilry.
Did you say a shape-shifting orc just now?
Tungdil broke in, stepping alongside Gandagar. They walked over to the assembly together.
Reports were vague, the High King answered. But magic was involved.
What? The snout faces and magic now? Murmured Ireheart. Have Tion and Samusin completely lost their godly senses, sending them after us? They can't be Girdlegard orcs. Damn sorcery. Never could stand magic.
Goda tagged along at a discreet distance. She was exhausted by the enforced march, and Ireheart was regretting his instructions to her. He might have overdone it, he thought. But he did not let it show.
Wait outside again, he said, adding a mumbled, have a bit of a rest.
Tungdil entered the tent and watched the sovereign rulers of Girdlegard take their places. He knew most of them. The human faces had aged quicker than the dwarves and elves, of course, in the last 5 cycles. The thorn of mortality was lodged deep in their flesh. He observed Ortka with curiosity. Ergon's young ruler was talking quietly to his neighbor at the council table, Queen Issachar, nodding repeatedly. Then he stood up with a respectful bow. Villanoil and Tiwaloon did not accord the dwarves a single glance. Their unfriendly demeanor warned Tungdil and Ireheart that the black finger marks must indeed have come to their notice. King Bruron stood up and tapped his ring against his drinking vessel, the melodic ping cutting short the assorted rulers' conversations. All their attention was on him.
"Let us get back to business, your majesties," he indicated Tungdil. "As you see, we have a trusted guest and old friend among us. One of Girdlegard's famous heroes, Tungdil Goldhand, has come to be with us in our dark hour. He will help us with our deliberations, I am sure."
Gandagar leaned over toward Tungdil.
"His gold cup is an inferior alloy. The sound it made wasn't good at all. Either the goldsmith has taken him for a ride, or he's having to cut costs but wants to keep up appearances.
And, of course, we're delighted to welcome Bowindil Doubleblade, whose services to our homeland are no less significant," continued Bruron with a smile. "We need heroes like these if we are to avert the coming dangers."
The rulers inclined their heads in acknowledgement. It seemed the elves had neck problems, but only the dwarfs noticed that. The king surveyed the room.
"As usual, when we meet, I have to start with unpleasant news. The statue of Lot Ionan has been removed from the rubble and stolen. Despite our best efforts, there is no trace of it."
Tungdil swallowed hard. He remembered clearly having seen the statue, which was his very own foster father, in Andakai's palace. Nudin, or rather Nodon, had turned him irrevocably to stone in the course of a battle many cycles ago. Secretly, the dwarf had hoped to bring the petrified figure back to the vaults, so that at least he could stand where once he had lived.
"What could anyone want with his statue?"
Malin looked at Tungdil.
"How should I know?"
he retorted sharply. None of the other Famuli were still alive. Otherwise, he might have thought them capable of carrying off their mentor's statue in order to honor it in some secret location. But the Magus had been so revered, they could have honored his statue in full public view. Tungdil felt the robbers had betrayed him somehow. The Magus had been a father to him. It was a personal attack.
"I can't understand it either," said Bruron. "But I shall have my soldiers continue the search."
He turned to Ortka.
"You have news for us, you said, King Ortka?"
"Yes.
A large town near Borwal has been destroyed. Annihilated. Not a single inhabitant has survived. All the signs point to it having been orcs or some other of Teon's monsters.
He noted the concern on their faces.
There is no longer any doubt. The beasts are back in Gerdlegard.
Gandagar raised his hand.
I, too, have terrible news to report.
He told them of the theft of the diamond and the poisoning of the dwarves, then handed over to Tungdil, who recounted how yet a further stone had been lost, and how a new version of Teon's creatures had appeared. Like all the others, Bruron sat thunderstruck.
Undergroundlings? Dwarfs from the Outer Lands in alliance with magic orcs to get the diamonds? Am I hearing right?
They're all in it together, Queen Issica said with conviction. The orcs, the undergroundlings, and these magic hybrids.
She addressed Gandagar.
You will have to face up to the question, High King of the Dwarves, of how these beings have been able to enter whenever they want, through the gates and over the passes.
The woman's voice was sharp enough to cut glass. She made no attempt to hide the fact that she had no faith in the dwarves' defense provision.
Against magic, we are powerless, admitted Gandagar. You are forgetting that the orc we have heard about was able to change its shape. If there are more of them, then they have probably been able to walk right into Gerdlegard unimpeded.
That would explain the finds in Taboribor.
It was Malin's turn. The search party I sent out after the village was destroyed found evidence of recent habitation in the old orc caves.
It's all coming together. So it was orcs, magic orcs, that stole Lot Ionan's statue, Queen Issica suggested. They took the last of our magic so we would have nothing to fight them with. She leaned back. We need a new magus for Gerdlegard. She faced Tiwalun. Perhaps one of the elves can weave magic.
The elf bit his lips.
Even if this were the case, there are no more magic force fields where we could source the powers.
He exchanged glances with Villanoil.
I did not want to mention it, not yet. But in the circumstances, we cannot keep the truth from you.
He took a deep breath.
Lord Lutacil is dead. He lost his life trying to defend our diamond. Ye gods protect us, whispered Queen Umalanti in horror. If even the elves are not safe from the beasts, who can help us then?
Total silence reigned. Nobody moved. No one spoke. They were able to pick up the sounds of the canvas flapping gently in the breeze and the guy ropes easing or taking the strain as the wind made the tent walls move.
We can,
Tungdil called out, determination in his voice. He was sick of seeing these powerful rulers behaving like frightened animals herded into a corner by cattle rustlers.
The children of the smith! And all of you! We overcame Nodon together, and together we drove out the Avatars.
He placed Keenfire on the table before the High King.
This weapon was able to inflict injury on that creature, and it will protect me from all magic attacks.
Wei regarded the impressive axe, and encouraging memories of past victories over evil returned.
He is right, but he can't be everywhere all at once. As I said before, let us take all the remaining diamonds to the safest of our fortresses, and let us give Tungdil Goldhand our best warriors. In this way we can protect the stones and perhaps recover the ones that have been stolen.
Malin applauded.
Let us cease talking up our fears.
We sit back waiting for the next onslaught. We need to act.
He stood up and went over to the map of Gerdlegard.
I suggest we take the diamonds to Imen Gao.
He drew his dagger and placed its point at a spot immediately below Parista.
King Bruron suggested the old fortress in Palland from cycles long past, when trolls and ogres battled for possession of Goregar.
It was never taken by the trolls. The walls were too high, too strong. It's been abandoned for ages. Farmers keep their cattle there.
Let's restore it to its former glory. I've already sent a workforce to Palin to start clearing the site, said Broron, turning to Gandagar. Be good enough to send us your best masons to have a look at the state of the walls.
At once, agreed the dwarf.
And the rest of you,
Malin addressed them with authority.
Send your best archers and warriors to Palland to occupy the battlements and to show a determined front to any who would rob us of our diamonds. Meanwhile, let the most knowledgeable scouts be sent through the caves of Taboribor to find those orcs.
He slammed his fist onto the table.
Long enough have we conducted ourselves like mice terrified by a cat. From the present orbit onwards, we shall be like wolves.
Issachar rose.
One condition. No dwarves in Palland, apart from Tungdil Goldhand and Boindil Doubleblade.
Gandragar lowered his head.
What is the meaning of imposing such a condition, Majesty?
You said yourself you are fighting the Thirdlings in your own ranks. If you cannot recognize them, how should we be able to? After everything that has happened, they might see fit to ally themselves with the orcs and the undergroundlings rather than fight on our side.
She did not avoid his stare, but answered him with all the sovereign dignity at her disposal.
I do not propose this to diminish you and your people. My only concern is to preserve the security of the fortress, no more, no less.
She is right.
Tiwaloon rushed to defend her.
The children of the smith must sort out their own house first. Send an army to the outer lands to find the camp of the Thirdlings who are pursuing you with death machines. Find them and destroy them. Sift out the traitors from your own ranks and make sure the gates to Gerdlegard are protected.
He bowed to Gandagar.
Twice the dwarfs have been instrumental in saving our homeland. Now it is the turn of the elves. We shall come to Palland with all the warriors we have. That was Lutasil's dying wish.
Issachar was the first to start clapping, and the others all joined in. The elves were nurturing that tiny seedling of hope sown by the dwarves, giving it water. Gandagar agreed. Then the whole-scale planning began. When and how to take the diamonds to the fortress Imengau, along which secret routes and under what security measures. Not until late that night had they managed to settle all the open questions.
Let's lose no more time!
King Bruron gave the signal to dissolve the assembly.
Is there anything more to discuss?
In all our concern about protecting the diamonds, there's something we mustn't forget. I extend my sympathies to you both, Tiwaloon and Villanoil, on the death of your sovereign lord.
Malin's voice was heard.
His death, and that of all who have died in defense of the diamonds, shall not have been in vain. But before we part, to meet again in Palland, tell us, who is to succeed Lutasil?
Villanoil smiled.
My thanks to you and all who mourn with us in our loss. In 10 orbits, I shall be able to answer your question, Prince Malin of Eiderslane. We are presently deliberating. Lutasil named no successor. We shall inform the realms of humans and the kingdoms of dwarves when joy replaces sorrow in our hearts.
The elves left the tent, and the leaders made their way back to their quarters. Malin and the dwarves remained there under the canvas roof, drinking up and thinking back on what had happened and on the plans that had been forged. Tungdil went over to the map to look at the locations of the village that had been destroyed and the town that had been wiped out.
It doesn't make any sense, he muttered. They are much too far apart to have been attacked by the same group of orcs in such a short space of time. And why attack them, but leave villages and farmsteads round about untouched? Orcs will always destroy everything in their path.
Maybe these orcs are different, interjected Malin. Gandagar, didn't you say that there wasn't a single death amongst the dwarves when the orcs stole the Fourthling's stone?
Odd, isn't it?
The very moment the blonde prince spoke, Tungdil remembered what had struck him as strange in the descriptions of the attacks. Neither the undergroundlings nor the mysterious orcs with the pink eyes had done any killing. The indiscriminate slaughter had only begun when the machine arrived in the lift hoist before retreating into the galleries and disappearing.
Cudgels, he breathed. The orcs attacked with cudgels. And the undergroundlings created that diversion in the Red Range. They injured people but killed no one.
And that was in spite of none of them surviving the battle. Two had previously evaded the Queen's Guard and gone off through the body of the mountain. They had all sacrificed themselves for the sake of this robbery. He put his suspicions into words.
Gandagar, we have to find those undergroundlings, alive, to interrogate them.
Ironheart saw it the same way.
They are giving their lives to recover their property.
Their property?
Chorused Gandagar and Malin.
My word, Ironheart.
Tungdil ran to his friend and grabbed him by the shoulders.
Of course! How could I miss that?
He hit himself on the forehead.
And they call me the scholar, he cried. It should be your name.
You'll never know.
Ironheart was immensely proud and felt the need to stroke his long black beard, but his hand met empty air. He had managed for a time to forget about that loss.
They're after the diamond, because it's theirs.
Tungdil turned to the prince and to the High King. Do you remember how we always thought a diamond with all those wonderful facets could only have been cut by dwarfed craftsmen?
By Vrakus, we must have been blind, exclaimed Gandagar,
conjuring up the exact image of the diamond in his imagination. His tribe had fashioned the imitation stones, and they had needed to apply every ounce of skill to come near to the original.
The Eoil had stolen it from the undergroundlings. And when they found out how powerful an artifact it has become, they wasted no time in trying to get it back. They know very well we're not likely to surrender it voluntarily, Tungdil deduced.
But what have the orcs got to do with the diamond? Why are they helping the undergroundlings to recover it?
That's what I was wondering, grunted Boindil. There can't be a pact of any kind between our kind and these beasts.
The undergroundlings must think differently on that score, Tungdil reminded him. The word pact gave him an idea.
This town and the other place that had been destroyed, do they have anything in common?
Apart from being located near the realms of monsters?
Malin studied the map. King Ortka didn't mention any alliance. I think that many cycles ago, when the trolls ruled Borwal, the town wanted to send out a troop to negotiate with the monsters. It was about mining rights. Tungdil looked at the lines delineating Taboribor.
This village will have paid tribute to the orcs in the old days, surely.
I expect so,
Malin suppressed a yawn.
Excuse me, I'm really tired and would like to go to bed.
Just one more question, said Tungdil.
When you faced the monster in Goldensheaf, did you see any elf runes on its armour?
So I'm not the only one with sharp eyes, said Malin.
He nodded.
I didn't want to tell anyone before I'd had a chance to speak to Lutisil about it.
Describe them.
Malin sketched them out for Tungdil on a piece of paper.
I think it means your,
Tungdil said, considering.
Our attackers had have on their wrist protectors.
Perhaps it's a message that won't make sense until all the monsters have appeared,
the Iverslain prince mused.
To the elves,
Tungdil was more specific.
The monsters are carrying a message to the elves. Whatever the purpose might be, they want the elves to piece it together bit by bit.
So they see themselves as unstoppable.
Malin pointed to the doorway.
I'll ask Ortka if he saw anything. Perhaps we can solve the puzzle, even if it's not intended for us.
He shook hands with the dwarves, wishing them good night, then left the tent.
"It's time for me as well," said Gundagar. "Tungdil, I want you to guard the Fifthling Stone on its way to the Grey Mountains and Palland. I don't want to take any more risks. Keenfire will be up to contending with any threats. There's none better than yourself to be entrusted with the task."
Goda and the two male dwarfs walked away from the square and were shown to their quarters by one of Bruron's servants. Ireheart told Goda briefly about what had happened and instructed her to take the first watch.
"Master, I am tired."
"Yes, I know. You walked in the sun carrying baggage."
He dismissed her complaints.
"But a warrior girl such as yourself must be ready to ward off an attack after a long march. Your enemies won't care whether you've had a rest or not. They'll be waiting come what may."
With a sigh, he slipped off his boots and his chainmail shirt, opened the fastenings on his leather jerkin, and collapsed on his bed.
"That's your next lesson."
"Thank you, Master."
She sat down on a chair by the entrance to be able to watch the door and the window at the same time. Tungdil lay down under his blanket and thought about the evening's long discussions. A thousand things went through his head as he searched for explanations more convincing than Issachar's. The undergroundlings and the orcs held one key to the events in Gerdlegard, and the beasts held the second one. Those keys would shed light on the secrets. Probably they would reveal even greater challenges in store for the homeland.
"Why did Tiwalun not say anything?" Boindel asked.
"About the stone?" Tungdil turned to his friend, who was sitting on his own bed and also seemed to be thinking hard. He was watching Goda.
"Would it have been better if he had?"
"Why am I having to keep watch if neither of you is even asleep?" asked Goda in a resentful huff.
"Don't worry, Goda. We'll be quiet soon," grinned Tungdil. "And as for you, Ireheart, I expect the new elf lord will summon you soon enough."
He turned to face the wall and closed his eyes. And then, just before he nodded off, he realized what the connection was between the two ravaged settlements. But by the next morning, the recollection had gone. Gerdlegard, Queendom of Wayern, early summer, 6241st solar cycle. Rodario was woken by a strange noise, and was astonished to realize that it was him making the clicking sound himself. Faster than a rabbit mating, his teeth were clattering against each other. They could have shredded his tongue to ribbons. He opened his eyes. Shaking all over, he threw himself onto his back and struggled up. There was a thick fog all around, but bright, as if the sun were about to come up over the horizon. He found himself lying on a shingle beach, with waves lapping around his legs and hips, pulling and sucking at him on the gravel, coaxing him back into their waters.
"Elria, I give you thanks for sparing my life. So you decided you didn't want an actor in your realm,"
Rodario stammered. He got to his feet to walk along the beach and look for help. He assumed he must be on one of the islands he had sailed past the previous night. Soon he came upon a fisherman's hut with nets hung out to dry.
"Anyone awake?" he called out, knocking at the door. "Please, let me in. I'm catching my death."
The door opened a little way. Two sets of curious young eyes peered out at him from the dark interior. Then the smaller girl disappeared. The older sister, maybe 11 cycles, studied him. She was wearing a worn old dress and two aprons. She had greasy short brown hair sticking to her head.
"Who are you?"
"My name is Rodario. My boat capsized."
He could not stop shivering. He was shaking like aspen leaves.
"Please, let me come in and dry my clothes by the fire.
Father is out fishing, and Mother said we mustn't let anyone in when she's off looking for herbs."
The girl considered him.
"You're not a pirate. You're much too thin."
She opened the door and let him in.
"Over there,"
she said, pointing to the open fire they cooked on.
"I'll put some more blocks on. But you'll have to pay. They're expensive."
"Thank you. What's your name, little one?"
He walked past her, striding to the fire in the middle of the hut, relishing its warmth. There was a smell of fish, of smoke, and of fat from a cauldron bubbling gently further along. Either they were rendering blubber or making soap. It was a miracle, he thought, wrinkling his sensitive nose, that they could put up with the smell.
"Fleera!"
She introduced five siblings, and then clambered up a ladder to get blocks of compressed seaweed for the fire. She threw them down to him.
"One coin each."
Rodario felt on his belt for his day's takings. He unfastened the purse and threw it over to the girl.
"Keep it. You need it more than me."
He piled the seaweed blocks on and enjoyed the heat they gave. With a suspicious look, she opened the purse and counted.
"That's 7. Thank you. May Elria bless you."
"She already has,"
he grinned, stretching out his hands to the flames.
"I survived that huge damn wave, but my boat didn't."
Fleera's eyes widened.
"Another one? When?"
He shrugged his shoulders.
"Some time ago."
Then he understood why she was asking. She would be scared for her father.
"Do these waves happen often?"
He pulled off his shirt and flapped the legs of his breeches about to dry better. He did not want to take them off in front of the children.
"Father says they never used to. Not till the earthquake and the flood. That's when he says the lake got so treacherous. As dangerous as any monster in Teon's dreams, he calls it."
Fleera sat down and passed him a cup of hot tea.
"They keep coming, and out of nowhere. 7 fishing boats have been lost just from here. He says other islands have fared even worse."
Her brother, called Ormadin, came over. The light in his eyes told the impresario that the young boy was fascinated by the occurrences on the lake.
"Tell him about the Alfar Nightmare Island."
Fleera cuffed the back of his head.
"Who said you could come and talk with the grown-ups? Tell him yourself."
"A nightmare island? Sounds intriguing," laughed Rodario. "I'm all ears, Omadin."
He sipped his tea and waited to hear what fairy story the boy would serve up. Omadin grinned and began.
5 cycles ago, just before the judgment star rose in the sky, a band of Alfar was abroad in Girdlegard, sent out by the unslayable siblings to look for a new and safer base. They came to Weyern and travelled through our homeland on a ship they'd made out of the skeletons and skins of humans and elves. They looked at island after island, solid ones and floating ones. Nobody saw what they were up to, and any unfortunate fisherman they met on the high seas got killed and eaten. One night, the Alfar landed on a wonderful island that awoke their curiosity. They saw it had mountains and caves where they could hide. They slaughtered all the inhabitants and took the island over, dragging the corpses to the caves where they skinned them and removed the bones. They were about to set up a spit to roast their kill, when one of them stuck his lance in the ground. It penetrated the island's crust. Water shot up and flooded the caves. The island sank down into the depths, together with the Alfar. That's how it escaped the effect of the Star of Judgment, whose power could not reach the bottom of Weyern's lakes. But Elria did not let them die. They were to do penance for the evil they had wreaked on the people of Weyern. She granted the Alfar everlasting life and condemned them to eternal exile on the island. Sometimes, when the stars are favourable, the Alfar are allowed up to the surface with their island, so that they may see the night. It's said that they will not die until they have covered the walls of every cave and grotto with paintings. Anyone surviving the huge wave they bring, and unwise enough to set foot on their island, gets eaten by the starving Alfar.
Their skin is torn off, and their blood used for cave paintings.
Omadin fell silent and looked at Rodario, his cheeks scarlet.
Did you like my story?